something related that you, I remember you saying to me that stuck with me, which was when I was in Guatemala when I took a when I left the island, the matrimonial island, for a bit of fresh air, and it was when I was getting involved with you more seriously, and I was feeling depressed. I don't know if I use that term, but anyway, I was dispirited, and you said something like, well, you made the analogy anyway of the prison break, as in if you're making a prison break, you have to make sure that nobody notices, you know, that what you're planning, as in the analogy I got was if people are plotting an escape from prison, they don't want to be walking around whistling and laughing and nudging each
That's
other
right.
all excited. They got to act like everything's normal. And so what it communicated to me was that for me to get free of my constructed identity, I can't let my constructed identity know
That's
what's
right.
happening.
That's right. Or I wouldn't let it know. Because the thing is that unless you can deputize a really wise and overseeing part of yourself, unless you can truly deputize it and give it permission, you've got to find it, you've got to give it permission, it's got to be able to do the job, then it's not going to be able to do something to fool your false identity, to be able to break you fully out or to clean up your system so that there aren't any more roadblocks in your body, fantasy Disneylands or horror, what they called the train rides in the fairground, ride of horror rides.
It's ghost train.
Getting late. Ghost trains. Well, ghost trains, one of them. Hmm. One of the expressions. But anyway, but you'd have to be able to do that. Now, the way that I see it is, I see it that the way that we're set up is we're like a tribe of chimpanzees or baboons. You know, we pick each other's fleas off of each other. It's not so easy to find your own fleas. It's quite nice having someone pick the fleas off you and eat them. So it's actually by interacting, this you scratch my back, I scratch yours, it's something that naturally happens, that we help each other come to greater awakening, greater awareness and greater freedom. Now, as I said, all good variables can be used for destructive purposes, and so you can get together with people and they can enslave you and imprison you. That's more likely to happen, which is why I always find it a precarious risk to allow spiritual seekers to gab away endlessly, because they're more likely to pull each other down than they are to lift each other up. But nonetheless, the power of coming together and helping each other out, in the end, possibly the only way. Because we are interconnected. So we're either going to be flowing good stuff to each other, light, a bright awakening stuff, or we're going to be flowing the opposite. And if you've been in an environment where lots of people are just giving you, drowning you out, pushing you down and depressing you with dark, heavy, conditioned stuff, then you definitely want to get away from that, and you want to experience the opposite, where people are handing you your freedom back, where they're not putting pressure on you, where they're not bullying you, where they're not getting you to chase after carrots that don't really exist and you don't need, and they're not offering you punishments, which of course you don't need either, but where you're able to feel and to find yourself more, not go deeper into your prison or into your cave or into your fantasy La La Land. But I'm talking about a cooperative process. That's where my attention is on these days, is a cooperative process. And this cooperative process has to be able to get to a critical threshold, and it has to be able to replicate itself. I'm looking at something that will outlive myself and will be like parallel distributed processing or a decentralized system, where each person is helping each other, but it's not being centrally coordinated, and it's coming from the natural life force and the wise intelligence that's inside each person to heal itself again. The thing is to get that kickstarted. It's like kickstarting an engine on a car. It's very difficult to get that car to move if you're just pushing it, but if you can get that engine to turn over, then it can go places. But you've got to get past that inertia and start getting that momentum going.
You've used the analogy in the past, and then recently, it's one I picked up in my first piece on you, the popcorn kernels in the pan that start popping.
That one I remember, because I was just thinking of it before you mentioned it.
Right, and you just used it in another meeting. And, what I want to ask about this, I mean, there's at least two angles, but from what you just said, I mean, that doesn't quite fit what you just said as an analogy, because, I mean, you've described it like you're just one kernel in the pot, the pan, and you just happen to pop before the others. But then you've also talked about how you've got to shake the pan so that the others pop and they don't get stuck and all the rest of it. So then you're not the kernel in the pan anymore. You're outside the pan shaking it, right? And that's in the description you just gave. I mean, a pop kernel in the pot doesn't help the others to pop. Just because one popped means the others are going to pop, but it doesn't assist the popping in any way, right? It's popped. Its work is done, right? So which are you then?
No, you shouldn't take these metaphors to the, you know, so seriously. The way that I shake the pan is from the inside. You know, you can rock a boat. You don't have to be on the outside of it. Also, for example, I can take people to the sauna. Now, I'm not the sauna. I'm not the heat, but I lead them into the sauna. If I'm taking an international group into the sauna, I'm probably going to have a little bit more experience than them about how to properly and healthily be in the sauna. So I'm going to be watching them, and I'm going to be checking to see, are they getting too hot? Are they getting dehydrated? Do they need to go and cool off? Have they remembered to drink some liquids? Things like that. I know that when you get hot, you've also got to cool down and you've got to hydrate. That's really important. So the thing is that participants are coming into the heat of the enlightenment transmission. I've just got to make sure that their experience is as comfortable as it possibly can be, as healthy as it possibly can be. I'm sure that you're aware, I think you may have spoken to people recently, that when people go through awakening, and we can see awakening as really coming out of one illusion and coming into a wide reality that doesn't have this numbed and dumbed down structure in which supposedly safety and order exists. And so a person could freak out. So this whole process of awakening, it's could be tricky, and so it needs some management. On the other hand, people have said to me, well, hey Dave, I mean, this is a guy you know, wrote to me and said, if there's this urgency, why be so cautious? But the thing is that we don't want people falling apart. That's losing everything as well. I mean, okay, we could play like what the military do. Well, we'll lose some, but we'll win the war. You know, but what happened to leave no man behind? So my thing anyway, for whatever reason, maybe I'm too cautious, but I'm a lot more cautious these days. In the past, I would be more into thinking that people could be pushed a little bit more and they could be blasted a bit more and they can handle it and Humpty Dumpty can always be put back together again. But my observations of people and experiences and stories that I've heard lead me to see that waking up is a precarious process, like surgery, like giving birth. The thing can go wrong at any point, like fermentation, like making pickles or leavening bread. It can go wrong at any point. and when it's about the human mind in giving up the false identity and switching over to your real identity and going through that no man's land, well, that's really tricky. That's coming all under the umbrella of one word: sanity. Right? That's what sanity is. Sanity is, do you have a working persona that can merge with the social consensus of what reality is? That's normally what sanity means. Now, you're going outside of sanity, but trying to appear to be still inside the social consensus so that you don't rock the boat, you don't attract too much attention, you know, weird things are kept away from you. Because, of course, nothing wrong with walking naked, right? Except it's against the law and people get offended. But if you've got your own land, it's, you know, and you've got a lake and you like to go in the sauna, it's actually really good to walk around naked. And it's allowed over here. You can walk around naked if you're on your own private property. Right? Now, in other countries, people would think that's already insane to walk around naked. But it's the most comfortable thing if you've come out of a hot sweat box, a sauna. The most comfortable thing is to be naked, and the most comfortable thing is to jump in the lake naked and then go back in the sauna naked and you know, just cool down. But not for some people. So the thing is that if you really wanted to live how you wanted to live, you're outside of the social consensus and it will kick back. So the trick is, how do you stay functioning? How do you not attract attention and get locked up in the loony bin? And how do you get all your marbles back? That's a juggling act.
You know, I recounted my premature enlightenment experience on the retreat, and how I was on the plane and I'd lost my mind and all that. I left out a detail that seems relevant now, which is that while I was sitting on the plane without my mind and waiting for the plane to take off, and I was convinced that somehow, because I was the one who was awakened, I didn't figure it out this way, but I was convinced that it was all up to me, you know, to direct reality and to get the plane to take off, and it wasn't taking off. And the first thing that I came up with that I had to do in order to make the plane take off was take off all my clothes, to jump up in the aisle, spread my arms and legs and shout happy at the top of my voice.
Yeah. Revisiting your childhood. Probably the last time that you were naked, jumping up and down, free, feeling the air on all of your parts, you were probably really happy. But one day you were told, Jason, this has to stop now. You're quite old enough. You're 4.
Right. So I got socialized, yeah.
Yeah, so you went back to it. And when I was having ideas about social liberation or feelings of social liberation, I wasn't even quite having them, but I was becoming more socially liberated, not in any very extreme way. I had the ideas of dancing up and down Oxford Street, skipping and dancing and singing and things like that. It's, in a way, it's a search to recover the happiness that we felt was ebbing through our fingers as we got progressively older, even just in our teenage years. So we were losing something, becoming more rigid, more afraid quite often, more complex, more confused. Life seemed really complicated. And I've heard it also of people going over to Thailand, India, other places. They all, and you, because you know one other case which we won't go into, right? They all seem to take their clothes off for some reason. Interesting, that. I think, you know, that could be a study in itself. Why do these people who seem to have some awakening or breakdown, or maybe an awakening and then a breakdown, or who knows how it all goes, but they all seem to take their clothes off.
Right. No, I hadn't thought about that and the correlation. But I was thinking, you know, I recounted that it illustrates how I'd lost my mind in in both senses, really. Like I had had this sort of this premature enlightenment experience where I couldn't find my mind anymore, but it didn't feel good. I was as far from happy as possible, and so I'd also almost lost my mind in the other sense, but fortunately not completely. As in, I was contemplating acting in a way that would be so unsocialized that it would be threatening, particularly on the plane. I mean, I actually was looking back on this incident some years after, and I found out that right at that same time, I can't remember how close it was, the same day or not, somebody had gone weird on the plane. They hadn't taken their clothes off, but they'd done something weird, and the passengers had all piled on top of that person and
Is
killed
this
them.
right?
That's right.
Oh, right.
So that could have happened to me. I mean, if I'd been a little bit further over the edge, and I mean, my expression of I felt these people needed to see what, I don't know, something. They needed to see something, and this was what I would express, like total uninhibition, right? But it actually would have been totally threatening to them, quite rightly, because I'd have been acting out of
If you
control,
forget
right?
the rules of the game, that's right. If you forget the rules of the game, you may lose your life, or you may go to jail and not collect 200, whatever. The other lesson in there is that if you want to communicate to people, you have to do it carefully. If they don't get your message the way that you want, and you keep trying to hammer it home, well, you may get hammered up on a cross yourself. Communication and what I'm communicating to people, it has to be done carefully. You forgot what the rules of the game was. You went around naked, but actually, I don't do this in my groups, but because I want to stay away from controversy. But I'm sure that dancing around naked, even better, doing it in a group, would be a highly liberating experience. I just wouldn't want to be associated with that, so I don't offer such services. I have to pass them on to third parties, not that I have one.
So that's very clear cut, and I didn't go around naked, by the way, just in case anyone thinks that you know something they don't. I never actually did take that step, but yeah, that's a very clear cut example. You're not gonna host, nude dancing rituals. Already been done. It didn't end well, right? But
Well, it still goes on today. Of course, it gets used, it gets abused, it can get corrupted. But if it wasn't used, abused, and corrupted, a group of people dancing around naked, and people do it in various ways in different places, people would experience a degree of liberation. I mean, imagine a bunch of nuns doing
well,
it.
they might, but I mean, one of the reasons it's got disreputable is it is very risky. I think even without this,
Yeah,
well,
it's
no,
risky.
I see. It's not, obviously the social context is what makes it risky, because if we weren't inhibited, but also, I mean, if we weren't inhibited, we wouldn't need to do it. So I think it is a good example that the risk isn't just that rumors could spread and, it could backfire. The risk is that it actually it would be too much too fast for those people. Like it would be too much liberation too quickly, and it could go various different ways. They might all start having sex, or
God forbid. Maybe he does
or it
forbid.
might come out in violence. As I'm just,
Yeah, it may do. I mean, but the thing is, I've been around people who have been naked for various reasons. I've been at festivals, I've been in communal saunas in festivals, I've been on yoga retreats where everyone was mixed and naked in proper saunas. I've been in meditation group with a group of friends, and we all just dance around naked. There was never any problems.
Right.
The worst thing that could happen would be, like in the naked sauna, that you'd be on the lower tier and you'd be having sweat dropping off of two tiers of arses above you. But of
Well,
course,
the
yeah, there may be things going on. Maybe I didn't notice, but I didn't notice anyone forcing themselves on anyone or anything like that.
Yeah, well, there's a, I mean, this is referring back to the meta point, which is about you exercising caution, and there's a principle here which I've referred to a lot in my social analysis in terms of social engineering and how to control societies, which is the if people collectively or individually experience too much liberation too quickly, the Weimar Republic is the big historical example, there will be a corresponding crackdown. And the reason that this happens socially is that there's an internal mechanism whereby we actually will punish ourselves, we will judge and condemn and punish ourselves because we
Yeah,
will
sure.
experience a degree of anxiety if we start behaving in ways that we have been conditioned not to behave because we've internalized that.
Sure. And that, as I said, the social liberation can come out as selfishness. And the degree of self-servingness is necessary for a person to explore themselves. If a person's always there for the sake of other people, being submissive and supplicant, never really find out their own dreams, goals, and desires. But a person can go quite far in that direction and become a superman in terms of their desires and egotistical desires, and they can start using other people. And then they can then, of course, come the backlash, because then people turn against them. They may lose all their friends, they may lose their support network. And then they feel bad that they were so selfish. And then, of course, they then go back to playing around with ideas about being selfless that have been given to them through various religious systems without coming into contact with their real conscience, with the real kind of ethical engine that's within inside them. They go for a prescription. So someone's told, well, look, if you want to do penance, do this. And then someone then gives them a prescription to do that may be very self-serving to the person who's giving them the prescription. And so they get caught up in this wheel of trying to pay off some karmic debt, constantly screwing up somewhere along the line because they're not really being authentic to themselves, having people tell them that they've done wrong, and then trying to do restitution again, and the restitution again is something that has been prescribed for them so that they can be used again. And it's an endless cycle. And none of those things have got anything to do with waking up, finding God or enlightenment or anything else. It's as a human system of exploitation, because humans are predisposed to do that.
It's the social reality we're in, so in that sense, they have something to do with it, even if it's a negative relation, as in what's preventing it. Because your orange juice metaphor is speaks to the natural, the simple natural state of things being enlightenment, like a very big, abstract, mystical word for something that's as simple as freshly squeezed orange juice. Right? So why isn't it available? Well, there's a whole social context for why, and even that needs some explaining.
Why isn't enlightenment available to people?
Yeah, I mean, that's I'm saying that that's what we're talking about now.
I think that people can't absorb it. That it's a bit like if you live in a moldy environment, then your intestines may lose some of their capacity to extract nutrition from the food that you have. Now, the food is abundantly around you, but you can't extract the nutrition from it. Similarly, I could give you half a ton of dirt and I could say, there's enough gold in there for you to become a very rich man. But you might say, well, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to boil it up in Le Creuset? You wouldn't know how to extract it, perhaps. So, or you couldn't extract it economically. So that what you're looking for is that. What I am more focused on these days than enlightenment is that the enlightenment transmission is there. You come into contact with the enlightenment transmission and suddenly everything becomes illuminated. come into contact with the enlightenment transmission and things make sense. Coming into contact, as I said, we're not independent from anything. What is enlightenment anyway? What is it, like a certain region of your brain becomes activated or some mystical place just switches on? Enlightenment, and there's precedent for this as part of the description, is interconnectedness, right? We've heard, you know, it's unity, consciousness, interconnectedness. That's all very abstract, and sometimes it kind of talks about someone's experience, sometimes it's a theological position. Where's the practicalness in all of that? What's really going on? Well, what I'm saying, I'm just saying it may overlap with those themes. What I'm saying is that enlightenment is where we're reconnecting to each other, not socially, but the life force that is the real who we are, which is not normally seen or felt or noticed or given the time of day. We're not normally doing that. We're treating each other as objects. We're treating each other as robots, as basically glorified phone switchboard customer service systems that I just have a recorded voice, press one for this, two for that. That's what we're becoming. We don't even look to see who is that person inside there, and does that person inside there turn me on to life? We don't look at each other like that anymore. I think we used to more in the past, in the 70s when everything was, 60s when everything was becoming quite sexualized. Now I think people don't even, they don't even really look to see, is there a life inside there? If the sexualized feeling is, well, it's becoming, it's always been like that, of course, to some degree of fashion, but it's becoming about what a person looks like on the surface. So does a person have red lipstick, or do they have certain curves? What's passing for beauty these days isn't really beautiful. I mean, maybe in a generation people will think it's beautiful, but it really isn't. This, the faking of plastic surgery and the faking of the human form, it's not. For me, covering up what a person really is, distorting it, changing it, is not beautiful. It's ugly. Now, I admit, people can be deceived by things. Makeup may sometimes help, but the thing is that quite often when something that may have some aesthetic appeal covers up something ugly, as soon as you look beyond the surface appearance, you see the ugly thing is still there. It's like, from a distance, an actor on a stage may look attractive. Get closer and you see that their eyes are red because they were hung over from the night before. When you get close and you look, but people don't get close and look. They look at celebrities normally from the distance. Get close to those celebrities, you see that that's a sad person, that's a tense person, that's an unhealthy person. But from a distance, because of their bone structure, because of the use of makeup, they look attractive. But get close. And that's the thing. Really, intimacy is about getting close to people. We want to feel there's a real person, a really healthy life force in there, someone who's really aware and paying attention, and that we're in their field. That's what we want. We want connection. This word connection came to me, of course, I've heard it. I was listening to today of the online event that I had on the 3rd of June this year, and I heard it, the word there, but I'd been thinking about it, that connection, I said it at least before that radio interview, if not in the radio interview that I did yesterday. For me, this is all about connection. I've been saying that to people that get into contact with me, but I haven't really expanded on that, that this connection is the key to everything. It's why we exist. It's what we're involved in. We're involved in connection. And when we're becoming disconnected, we are feeling lifeless and everything is going wrong. You start disconnecting a body, you start disconnecting a switchboard, you start disconnecting an electronic system, and it will start to fail, it will not function optimally, and eventually it will be completely kaput.
Mm-hmm.
Start disconnecting things that shouldn't be disconnected, and we're asking for trouble. And of course, I know that you'll be thinking of how that applies in a number of ways: physically, chemically, nervous system, hormonal system, the brain, a connection to nature, a connection to each other. Mm. Start messing around with that, and you just don't have a life anymore. And that's already started to happen, that everything's becoming dismantled.
Yeah, and you could see that as within, so without, that people are fragmented internally, they can't connect to parts of themselves, and then they only can connect to each other through some small fragment, and so then people's fragments are connecting and
become top heavy. Yeah, I mean, not top heavy. They become top heavy in a sense that they invest everything in a fragment.
Yeah.
So there are some people that just meet through their minds, some people that just meet through their bodies, some people that just meet through their emotions, some people that just meet through train spotting. That's true, you know.
Yeah, you know, and it can, I mean, it can be an opening, of course. One can use anything as a starting point to connect, but
yeah, but it just shows that we want to connect as well. Old ladies will get together at the bus stop and talk about the buses because we want to connect. The thing is, do they dare go beyond talking about the buses, and do they dare go beyond complaining about the buses?
Yeah, yeah. And it's, how quickly does talking and that superficial connecting actually become a way to avoid a deeper lock-on?
Exactly.
The life force is locking
That's
on.
That's right. That's right. That's right. I'm going to bring you back to talking about buses now, Jason, okay? Because you're definitely getting into some very dodgy territory, young lad, and you've got to buck up your ideas and remember that buses are the infrastructure of our British society.
Uh-huh. You're testing my ability to stay centred in what I know.
Well, I don't know now, but anyway. Yes, I guess I was.
Actually, I had a question, stay centered in my question, to keep the conversation going, which is this, and maybe you've never been asked this before, maybe you have. Do you think that your experience that you've termed enlightenment, that big shift you had, do you think it was directly related to your connections to other people at that time?
Well, I don't know about exactly at that time. 2 days before I became enlightened, I was doing a course of something to do with body work. But when I went back and spoke to the people, I said, look, you know, I got enlightened. They were like, we don't really know what's going on. Maybe go and talk to someone else. I just didn't really know what I was talking about. I've met people, I'm sure you have too. They can be small interactions with people, but they can have an influence upon us. But those people themselves wouldn't necessarily understand the enlightenment that I've had either. I mean, there was one person that I think that they might have had some kind of awakening. They definitely talk about it. They had an effect on me when they took me through a kind of system of talking, and maybe they were doing more than that. But we've never really had, I tried to have a conversation with him, but it didn't necessarily go too far. Years later, they said to me, we could have a conversation. But by that time, I wasn't interested in following anything up with people. I didn't need validation or even to talk about. I mean, the interesting thing is that when you said to me earlier on, you don't really have that vacuum suction effect that you have with other people going on. If with some people, if there's nothing to do, then there'd be nothing going on between me and them either. I guess. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's different types of value and different value that we can have in relationship to one another. But I mentioned to you that someone contacted me not too long ago. They said that since they'd met me many, many years ago, that they were awakened and that they wanted nothing from me, and even that they wanted nothing from me particularly when they met me many years ago. And so I was puzzled about what we're really going to talk about. We can talk about stuff, but it's like, but why are we really talking? I'm still puzzled. I still don't quite understand it. I don't think a finger was really put on what the reason was. And if a person has a mindset that, well, I don't really need anything, well, that's already a very peculiar place to start from. Now, I can understand a person might say, well, I don't need certain things that you're offering. But if they're getting together with you, then you think that they've got better things to do with their time if they don't really need anything. Maybe it's just two different meanings of the word need. I could say to you, for example, I don't need anything from you, Jason. Right? Well, it's kind of true. I mean, you know, you don't cook for me and stuff like that. And I can keep coming up with my own ideas. But the thing is, I could also say, Jason, I really need you. And then I could say, well, I don't really know why I'm saying that. But I could say that I need you to be in existence. On the other hand, if you die, I'll probably get over it. So if I go somewhere deep without censoring myself, right? And this is really important, not to censor yourself. I could say, well, I really need you. However, I might not talk to you for years after that. I mean, I'm talking about some deeper reality that has nothing to do with you as a material, social, intellectual person. I could say that it's tricky, but it could be that I'm talking at some level of truth that's got nothing to do with this human realm and nothing to do with who you think you are either, by the way. And I'd be very wary and careful about saying things like that to anyone, because they would get a big head or start working an angle or having ulterior motives or getting their ego stroked. I'm really pointing to something here that is got nothing to do with Jason. And maybe that voice, because I was trying to figure out what that voice is, maybe that voice is saying that we all need one another, souls. Because souls don't have rights. All kinds of people can get rights in this world today by claiming that they're this and they're that. But souls, they don't even, you know, it's not written into any constitution that souls have rights. And that souls are, in fact, independent, partly, from the body. That souls could be considered kind of separate entities, or that souls have more wisdom than false identities. These kind of things, no one's talking about these things, looking to give them rights. It's a very unfair world. It is actually a very unfair world. I mean, you know, if you just look at law, how people can be mistreated and never get justice and never be compensated for it, because the law just somehow just isn't set up for that. I don't know how it goes, but it just seems that fairness and justice isn't built into the law. It's like things can happen to a person and then it's like tough luck. The law doesn't actually support you. It's the law.
Well, maybe souls have an imperative. I don't really believe in rights, as I think you know, but they have an imperative to live in the body, to dwell in the body, but society has other ideas about what our bodies are useful for.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so when your soul wants to take control of your body and do things which are genuinely useful and healthy, all of the forces of society, the law, the culture, your peer groups around you will try to dissuade you. You're making a mistake. You're not going to earn any money. You're not putting money away for your pension. You're not going to have an insurance. You're not going to be liked. No one's going to employ you. You're never going to work in this town again. There are so many forces at work, but it's all around survival. Now, I'm not saying what a person should do. I'm pointing out that there is a reality, which is about survival, that if you're part of the system and you don't follow the system, then it could become very hard to make some money.
Well, it goes deeper as well, the internalized survival of the false identity, because my Grinch symptoms were like how my body was, how it was experiencing the proximity of my soul was very unpleasant. It was quite painful, you could say. I mean, maybe it's not the proximity, but the more awake my body became, the more aware of the discomfort of it. And so then there was an incentive not to awaken, just at a physical level, right?
Yeah, shut down. The system. The system tries to shut itself down. Definitely there are these fail safes that when a person has a little bit too much energy, the system needs to shut down. It's like a nuclear reactor. If it's starting to get too hot, it's got to have a fail safe to shut down. And the same thing, that you will become uncomfortable. If there's discomfort in your body and you start to become aware and you haven't yet fixed it, then you're going to become more uncomfortable. I mean, the painkiller doesn't take away pain. It just makes you unaware of the pain. So if you forego the painkiller, if you become more aware, guess what? You feel more uncomfortable.
Yeah,
but then you might be able to fix it. You might be able to fix it once you're aware of the pain. You know, say you've got a stone in your shoe and you're numb to it, you can't fix it. It might start burning a hole in your foot. But once you're aware of it, you're like, oh, okay, take my boot, tip it upside down, out comes the stone.
Well, I had to learn to modulate, you know, how much was just enough and not too much. So it was like saunas were a good way to... it was a good sort of concrete example of that, because I would start feeling really bad almost as soon as I was in a sauna. I really would feel the detoxing happen. And so if I stayed in a sauna too long, I might actually get sick the next day. So it was really calibrating my levels of...
That happens with people that have a lot of toxins in their body that can be there from mold, from chemicals, from heavy metals, from all kinds of things, that they have so much, and that a little bit of a detoxification method like a sauna could shift so much in a short period of time. It's just overwhelm for them. Same thing as if someone starts an exercise regime, that will start the toxins pumping around the body. So it's easier for someone to sit on the couch, watch TV and have another bag of potato chips than to actually start walking and start feeling their body, the aching joints, the toxins moving around.
Yeah. And as you know, that was the one of the first most palpable ways that I had to acknowledge the effects of transmission on the retreats was I got sick about 3 or 4 retreats, and usually with the same symptoms, like my ear and my throat, and quite extreme. I even had to go to the hospital that one time.
It's not a very good sales pitch, but this is just a fact that, you know, that is a reality for a number of people. Strong detoxification, feeling uncomfortable.
Mm.
That is a reality, and that's why I say that, you know, can't really force people on this path. Can't say to them, welcome to the holiday camp, you will get a nice massage and you will feel rejuvenated immediately. No, you won't. Mm. To get rejuvenated, you have to, the gunk has to come out.
Mm.
If your body is full of boils and sores, well, they have to be lanced.
So I've got this sort of image, and we're going to wind up soon, so I don't want you to get tired. Yeah. It's been a long time, but...
Yeah, and I've got to eat. It's late at night. I've still got to cook.
All right, so we'll maybe end on this one then. You were talking about... Well, we were talking about the popcorn and the pot and all of that. And the... had this... It's not really an image, but... You attribute your enlightenment to the enlightenment transmission. So at a certain point, you were this kernel and you were in the right environment where the heat got enough that you popped. You turned inside out and you became...
It cleaned me out as well.
Right. So there was a
heat detoxifies. So that doesn't happen with a popcorn exactly, right? But the heat was detoxifying me, right? Or let's just say... My system, another way to see it, because if you really want to get for the metaphors, we've got to chuck some other ones in here. My system was starting to go through a cleaning process, right? And as it gets cleaner, then there's space. It sets up like a vacuum. Then it can suck in more of the life force that exists around us.
Right.
Right, and that leads to more connection, and that leads to a positive cycle of cleansing and opening up and sensing and becoming aware. Mm. And dropping erroneous patterns and unhealthy patterns of behavior and thinking.
Mm. And then then there was the final shift.
Yeah, which is still, you know, still haven't quite figured it all out.
Yeah, so, and this wasn't my question, hopefully I'll still be able to get to it, but... Would it be reasonable to describe that metaphorically, poetically, as your soul was getting closer, and hence the heat was increasing and the detox, and then at a certain point there was a full landing of your soul?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit like using a plunger on a sink.
Mm.
Or on the pipes, right? So the pipes were getting cleared out, but also, in a way, the pipes were getting cleared out because the soul was coming in and coming through. And then everything became more interesting. So again, the word connection, the most important thing, first of all, is to happen, is that there is a connection. Without a connection, nothing can get initiated. So my soul, I was connecting to it, and it was coming in more and more and more. But it can't come in, and we can't get the beneficial effects, and we don't get this positive cycling where we want more of it because we're getting more of it because it's healthy and it's beneficial and it's clearing stuff. That can't start without getting that connection. And I think that through the energy work practices that I was doing, that's part of it. Like, I don't see energy work as exactly as enlightenment transmission. The energy of that is not always enlightenment transmission. But by doing this energy work, I started to connect into something bigger than myself. The energy work, first of all, starts by cleaning inside the body, but eventually energy work becomes connecting to existence.
Mm.
Right? So we start local, but then we go universal. When you've mentioned the word soul today, it's kind of useful, but it's like the popcorn thing. I think it can break down in a model sense. What I would say is that the energy of the universe came through me.
Mm-hmm.
Not the physical universe, but of creation. that's how I see the Enlightenment transmission. But with it, of course, it will have a corrective influence, just like you go and see an osteopath and they correct your spine and your spine starts to readjust and your vertebrae ideally should start to line up again in the correct alignment. So you've got this person who's paying attention, using skill, using wisdom to crack your back, but after that your body's got to take over and sort itself out. You can't have this person permanently holding your vertebrae in place. They just initiate and they work with the forces that are inside your body. So the Enlightenment transmission coming through me is going to dislodge, let's say if we're going to talk about the soul, it's going to dislodge that wherever it's stuck. I sometimes talk about it as awareness. It's going to dislodge it and then it's going to come into my body and go through. But it's not simply my willpower making my soul come into my body. It's not simply that my soul wants to descend into my body. It's part of an interlocking system. It's just like if you want to relax and detox, sometimes you could just go out in the sunshine. Don't do it in a cold, dark room. You go out into the sunshine. So the nature existence, it's all about being interconnected, connecting, and it will all work together. So it's important to have all of the parts here, as many of the parts you can get working together, the faster will be your re-entry, your soul, if we're going to use the word soul, coming into your body. As many parts as we can get coming together. That's why I give advice, you know, which involves lifestyle and air and water and earth and nature and breath and relaxation, staying away from electromagnetism, mobile phones, Wi-Fi's, strong electrical fields. That's why I talk about all these things, because all those things, they work together, and Enlightenment transmission, it all works together.
Lost in a spinning hologram. I'm just a dizzy dying man. This world has changed beneath my feet. From green grass to crippling calm. Thank you.
So the analogy that I had, and I think your metaphor of the sunshine fits with it somewhat, was that was a view as a conductor, as in that the Enlightenment transmission was suffusing your life and acting upon you in these mysterious ways until a certain point where you became suffused in it. As you say, the energy of the universe was coming all the way into you and through you. So at that point you became, I don't feel comfortable saying what happened to you or defining your experience, but I'm trying to, as somebody on the outside, trying to understand some of your metaphors better, which is that, as I said, you know, the metaphor of the kernels in the pot doesn't work because the popped popcorn doesn't affect the other things. But my experience with you is that you do affect my experience around you and the people around you, because the heat, to use the metaphor, of the transmission is hotter around you, because even though it's coming in all the time from everywhere, it's particularly concentrated in you. So then,
yeah, I was explaining some of this to a newcomer just before talking to you today, and what I pointed out is that Enlightenment transmission is everywhere, and from meeting me, just having one tiny contact with me, you get all the Enlightenment transmission that is available, but you can't extract it. Just like, as I said, if I give you half a ton of dirt, you won't be able to extract the gold from it.
You mean, so from one, you mean from one meeting they'll get all that they were going to get
from half a second meeting with me?
Yeah, all they'd get from you,
but it's all there. It's all here. The reason why, and it's just speculation, why is it useful to meet with me? Well, one, I'm a human being, and so maybe I have more connections with another human being than a tree. Right? I communicate, I can work with a person's mind. But it seems to me, yet, that the Enlightenment transmission is concentrated around me. This is model, these are just theories, though. There's a lot of concentration of Enlightenment, and I let it come through, and I don't hold back on it. Or maybe I do a little bit, right? But the thing is that I'm faithful to the Enlightenment transmission, that the intuition, the spontaneity, the sense of what must happen in connection between me and another person, I'm not holding that back. I'm not afraid of that. I might not talk about certain things.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that the flow that's going on, in fact, I talk about all kinds of things, and that's a discussion, isn't it? Whether I'm talking, what I'm talking about is in sync with what's happening, or what a person is aware of, which isn't all of what's happening, or whether I'm talking counterposed to that, whether I'm being ironic about it, whether I'm actually just completely talking about something that doesn't even seem to be in any way related to what's going on. There's all these different linguistic methods, different ways of highlighting things by using irony, opposition, being congruent, over-highlighting, over-emphasizing. There's all these different ways to talk. But the thing is that the main thing that's going on, it's got nothing to do with language. It's not coming from language. It's not coming from our linguistic concepts. That's just part of it. But anyway, but the thing is that it seems that when someone comes into contact with me, there's a concentrated blast of Enlightenment transmission which would otherwise be diffused. Now, how that actually happens, models can be further broken down. Is it that I have more Enlightenment transmission? Is it that I'm able to, like, marshal the winds and bring more Enlightenment transmission around someone else? Is it that I rub some kind of grease fat off of a person so that they can experience Enlightenment transmission because they keep blocking it out? Is it that I part a gap between their thoughts so that the Enlightenment transmission can come through and that they can pursue it? There's all kinds of possibilities, and maybe all of them are happening, or maybe something else is happening that I haven't even covered just now as possible theories. All I know, the whole reason why the word Enlightenment transmission even exists, the whole reason why I get together with people, is because something happens. That's all I know, and that's what you and others know as well. Something happens, and that something is worthwhile. we're speculating about why we get together and what really goes on and how it can happen and whether enlightenment transmission is the right word and whether soul is the right word. All we know, and this is the really important thing, is that something's happening, and that is really primarily what we should look at. If we want to assess, is this healthy, is this good, is this beneficial, is this constructive, then look at the mineral water. Don't go away with some company that has a vested interest. Don't go away with their lab analysis, right? Because a marketing company will tell you, yeah, this is really good for you, right? Because a tomato has got this inside it. Well, maybe the tomato's got some other things inside it that aren't good for you. So don't just take the narrative that someone else is giving you. Now, the narrative that I'm giving you is based upon cultural language. And I keep coming back to it. The reason why the people who are still around me are still around me is because of what they are receiving from the enlightenment transmission, or let's just say what something. Ask them, you know, but they're around and they're definitely very enthusiastic, as you are yourself. There's definitely something going on, and there's a danger, and I said this to someone earlier, there's a danger that you will filter out what's going on, as maybe I said this to you earlier, when you arrive at a theory, an idea, a set of concepts to look at this, like the popcorn one, it will break down. It will totally mislead. If we come up with a popcorn religion, we will create massive error.
That's one reason to put it under the microscope, then, is to watch
put
it break down.
Put the experience under the microscope, and every beneficiary, every participant has an angle, and some of them can catch what's going on, some of the sensations. Some of them notice the changes in their lives, some of them notice the changes, the knock-on effects in the lives of people around them. Some of them don't, some of them have noticed it, some of them forget it, some people are not great with words. We all need to come together to pull all of our perceptions and sensations and experiences and stories and theories and ideas. We can do that. We don't actually even have to do that, because, you know, we can just drink the water. It's good to drink and it's fine. But of course, there is this other thing, which is to try to put it into words, which that's really for people that don't have the experience. You know, the people that have the experience, they don't. But I don't think they need to put it into words unless they want to communicate with someone else. I don't personally have to put this into words for myself. When I'm walking in the forest, I don't need to have a running commentary about what the trees look like. I only need that running commentary if, for example, I want to improve my ability to identify certain plants that exist in the forest. Then I may have to go through taxonomies and descriptions, and it has this stem and it has this flesh and it has this rooting pattern, and it, when you bruise it, it goes this color. If I want to identify certain things, then I have to mentally go through a taxonomy. But if I'm just enjoying the forest, I don't need to have any self-talk.
You might want to describe the forest to encourage someone to join you in the forest, and then
that's what I'm saying. It's only for the purpose of communication to another party.
Yeah, but that could lead to you having a richer experience of the forest if someone else is there with you, and just this shared experience that somehow amplifies the experience, I think.
Yeah, but and as I said earlier, though, the fact that we're both talking about the forest could actually cut us out of the experience. That is, in fact, more likely to happen when I go quiet. That's when so much insight and inspiration happens. It also happens, of course, when I'm talking, that I'm like, wow, where did that come from? That's really interesting. That happens every day, and it's another angle on the enlightenment transmission and the experience that happens around the enlightenment transmission. But when I go back to the words, they're not the thing. They're not the thing. And that's why when you and other people say to me, hey, do you remember that thing that you said? And I'm like, no, I like discard it as quickly as I've said it. It's like I've said it.
Yeah, well, that communicates much more strongly than saying that the words are not the thing, because there's that, you know, the all credence and morons conundrum. If you're saying the words are not the thing, then you saying that is not the thing either, right? So, but it does communicate through your way of being, which is your non-attachment to words. And I think that that's much more precious and much more rare, like an ability to really enjoy words and use them and value them, while at the same time not being attached to them, because we're speaking animals.
It's a sideshow. Words are a sideshow, though. They're not the main entree. It's like the menu, you know, like, you know, some menus, mm-hmm. they're really written in a exciting. Well,
what about the logo? What about the logo, son? I know I said we were going to wind up, but I did want to bring up Christ. So there we go. What about the logos? In the beginning was the word. That's not just some social engineering, you know, priestcraft stuff. There's deep wisdom in that, I believe. So there's something about the word that's not a sideshow. That's front and center to the incarnation.
Which word are you talking about?
The logos. It doesn't actually mean word. It means this logos. It's the ratio. It's like the ratio between the infinite and the finite. So somehow, when we articulate, we express the inexpressible, and that's like a metaphor, an embodiment of what we're always doing as living creatures the whole time. We're embodying the infinite, which is a paradox. How can you embody the infinite?
Well, I don't, maybe, I don't know. I mean, I just see a whole lot of danger in seducing people to use words. I see it like Facebook. I see Facebook as seducing people to send text messages to each other, to pull them in to an unreal world that will start to warp and distort them, use up their time and energy and addict them. And I know that there are people who think that it's a worthy project to put into words enlightenment transmission, all these phenomena. They think it's a worthy project, but as far as I can see, some of them are just dry, dusty old farts who will never experience this and don't actually care to, because they're procrastinating, because they're staying out of it, and they'd rather have conferences about this.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that there are conferences about awakening.
Of course there are. Well, you do meetings about enlightenment, so it's not a million miles.
No, because I'm not there primarily to map something out, although that's what I'm doing as a sideshow. I'm there to change people, and part of that is to try to sell the idea that people, you know, need to give up their old identity and come into their new. But that's just a sideshow. What's going on beneath the surface is what's really happening.
So do you think that if everybody was enlightened, and I never got to my real question, my last question, which is about collective awakening and how, well, anyway, do you think that if everybody was enlightened, we would stop talking to each other?
No, we stop talking about enlightenment.
I think that's actually a great point to end on.
You are merciful. I mean, I thought you were going to stop at 2 hours. I'm on the clock here, it's 4 hours 20 minutes.
Yeah, well, I was going to milk you as long as I could.
I'm assuming you're going to cut some of the crap out then, because, you know, like, I think that, yeah, I said some things that they're not fantastic. You know, I just thought I'd just chuck in a few irreverent things. But the thing is, of course, I did aim during this talk to try to appeal to your audience. I tried to be controversial, rebellious, hip.
You know, we'll include this in the podcast, don't you?
If I give it to you. Well, that's it, you know, your gonzo thing, you know, show everything.
Yeah. Right, that's the end of that 4-hour, 20-minute conversation with Dave O'Shaughnessy. There were some edits, and I will share most, if not all, of those edits in an extra audio of outtakes. It will be linked along with this one. I haven't decided yet, but I may also share the whole conversation as one audio file without musical breaks and stuff if people just want the full experience. I'd like to suggest or request that people comment on this conversation. There hasn't been much commentary at the podcast, less than usual, I'd say, even though this is a more significant podcast than usual, and I definitely would be interested in your feedback. So please do share your thoughts and your responses to this dialogue with Dave O'Shaughnessy. Next week I'll be talking to Kerry McCoy. After that, I believe it's going to be the Jonathan Lethem. The new website's up and going, or the blog has moved rather. Do subscribe if you haven't already. Let me know you're out there. And keep on liminalizing.
I hear a voice that's not my own. It tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen. Some point they become the family of